This is Season 3, Episode 1 of the Language Mastery Show with Chris Vaselli. Here's a little sample of what's coming up.
Especially for people that are new to the language, I think there's a lot of fear around the writing system that I think gets a little bit blown out of proportion. I think people talk about, oh God, there's three different alphabets you have to learn in Japanese. Right. And one of them has thousands of characters. It's right. Like, okay, that sounds scary, but I actually sort of have a different perspective on that, where, you know, when you look at hiragana and katakana, first off, they're really two sides of the same coin, mm-hmm. right? They're like, every character in hiragana has a corresponding character in katakana. They represent the same set of sounds. Many of them look similar across them. Many of them don't, but mm-hmm. but a good chunk of them look the same or have similarities. And to me, we have the exact same thing in English, in uppercase and lowercase characters.
Welcome back to the Language Mastery Show. This is your host, John Fotheringham. In today's episode, I chat with Chris Vaselli, a programmer, passionate Japanese language learner, and the creator of the Nihongo iOS app, which is currently my go-to Japanese dictionary and also one of my favorite tools for reading authentic Japanese content. In the interview, Chris and I discuss how he learned Japanese and how you can learn it in a more fun, natural way by doing things like playing video games, reading manga and watching anime, and much, much more. For show notes, go to languagemastery.com/show. All right, here's my chat with Chris Vaselli. So usually where I like to start with my guests is go all the way back to the sort of beginning of their language learning journey. Of course, you know, we're both focusing today on Japanese specifically. So it's, I think, relevant to talk about this sort of in a manga way. So if this were a manga version of your life or an anime, like what would be the origin story of you, the language learning hero, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I started learning Japanese my freshman year of high school. So I had taken French and Spanish in middle school. Once I got to high school, they offered Japanese, and you know, I was into video games and anime and things like that as a kid. So definitely, like, once I got the opportunity to take Japanese, that seemed much more sort of interesting to me right. than French or Spanish. Yeah, and I took Japanese through high school and got really into it. I went to, there's a Japanese learning camp, like a summer camp called Mori no Ike. So I went to that during high school. And when I went to college, I you know, continued taking classes. So I had definitely a big, like, classroom experience with Japanese for a long time. But then, you know, once I got to college, I ended up finding that my Japanese classes were taking probably as much time as all of my other work combined.
Right.
So it was just a huge amount of work. And I finally just kind of like decided, you know, to take a break from it for a bit. So I took a break for a while, but then I went with my husband. He wasn't my husband at the time, but we went and traveled a bunch after college. And one of the places we went to was we did a homestay in Japan.
Oh, cool.
And so that was kind of the moment when I like really just fell in love with Japan. I really loved living there. And so we went ahead and the next year applied for the JET program. Mm-hmm. So we both applied. He got in, I didn't. But so I just got to like go with him and do my own thing. And I ended up like taking full-time Japanese language classes.
So you actually probably got the better end of the stick in many ways.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I got to leave and not have a job.
Yeah. Where were you guys stationed?
And yeah, we were in Nishinomiya, which is near Osaka.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in the Kansai area, which I also totally fell in love with Kansai.
Yeah.
We were there too.
It's the best part of Japan. I mean, they know, we know. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was in Kansai also when I was there. So yeah, that's great. Okay, so you started pretty early then with Japanese, I think, compared to a lot of folks that get into it maybe in college or even later on. And I do find it interesting that definitely a lot of folks, I think, listening are going to relate to getting into Japanese via interest in manga or anime. I was sort of the opposite. I was a late bloomer. I started reading manga and started watching anime because I wanted to learn Japanese.
Oh,
so I was
already
learning it. So it was kind of the other way around for me. But yeah, it's definitely a good gateway drug, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think back to when I first started and I was really into video games. And I think there were things like I feel like one of the early things was I was just really into the idea of playing games before they came out in the US. Mm-hmm. So like, I think I was waiting for like, it was probably like Final Fantasy X at the time, maybe, or something like that. And it was like, these games had come out a year before. And oh, if only I knew Japanese, then I wouldn't have to wait like everybody else. I could just, you know, play right away. So yeah. So that was kind of one of those initial motivations.
Yeah, good incentive. Gaming's an interesting thing. I never really was a gamer, but I do think it's a really powerful tool for language learning. I mean, it's so context rich, especially a lot of the RPG games now. You have, you know, you're getting audio input, you're getting reading input, you're having quasi interaction with other people in air quotes, you know. But just on that tangent, are there any particular games that you really loved and you felt were really helpful for Japanese?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I still like playing games in Japanese is still a big part of how I keep up with Japanese. And I definitely find the older ones, I think, are a little bit easier to handle. I think the Japanese level has gotten higher as the sort of target audience kind of the age range that games are targeting gets older as everybody grows up. And like, it seems like in the 90s, everything was kind of aimed a little bit younger. So
that's an interesting point. Yeah.
And then I also find I really like playing games that I've already played in English before is a useful technique for me too, just because then I find I don't have to be worried about getting lost. You know, like if I get somewhere where I like, you know, miss some key line of dialogue or something, and then I don't have to worry about being like totally lose the enjoyment of it because of that.
Yeah, that's a really important point I want to underscore here for listeners, is that you're making the input comprehensible, which is a really important, I think, part of effective language acquisition. This is a concept that Stephen Krashen talks a lot about, that, you know, just getting input is not enough. And I think that's where a lot of people go wrong, is they think, oh, I just need to flood myself with as much Japanese as possible. And it's like, yes, however, you need to do as much as you can to make that input comprehensible. Because if you don't understand the basic gist of what's happening, it's going to be boring and you're probably going to quit and you're not going to stick with it.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really wise thing of doing the English thing first. Or, you know, another parallel to that I often recommend people change their like phone language to Japanese, but make sure you understand the basic interface first. Like if you get a new iPhone or you're upgrading your iOS, like figure out what is what first and then probably switch to Japanese. So
that's pretty much the exact flow that I go through. There's some big new update, you know, maybe I'll switch back to English for a tiny bit. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, especially with something like your phone where you're worried that you're going to press the wrong thing and then like, I don't know, do something really disruptive.
It'll blow up. You'll delete your entire photo library or something.
Exactly. Right.
So specifically, what are some of those games then that were some of the older ones that you enjoyed and that you would recommend to people that want to start using gaming as a way to learn Japanese?
Yeah, I mean, I think the old Final Fantasy games, I'd say Final Fantasy VI and Final Fantasy VII are both great. They're really good. Difficulty level that isn't too high. Like some of the more recent ones are really high. If you go back older than that, I think Final Fantasy IV is all hiragana. And a lot of, once you get, you know, past a certain point, especially into any sort of like 8-bit games, like NES era games, they just didn't have the graphical fidelity to display kanji. So it's all hiragana.
Right.
And I just find that miserable to try to read.
Yeah, it's hard. Somewhat paradoxically, this might shock some people that are maybe just starting out in Japanese and are still learning, you know, the kana, but it's once you're used to reading a fair amount of kanji, reading hiragana is actually harder because your brain is used to parsing words based on the kanji. You know where the word boundaries are, you know what are the compounds, and then suddenly it's this big long soup of kana. Like reading kids books, for example, I find actually and somewhat ironically to be challenging in its own way. Not only because they're...
Well, so you got to remember that kids are coming from a really... Japanese, native-speaking Japanese kids are coming from a really different place than we are. Like, they have a huge vocabulary that they just don't know how to read.
Right.
And we are coming from this different perspective where we, like, you know, don't have the vocabulary and, like, need all this help to, you know, supplement that. So, the hiragana-only stuff can be really tough.
Yeah, it's just unfamiliar. I mean, I'm sure if it's something... If you did it all the time, then it would get easier. But... why bother? It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing to really look for with games that I do is finding games that have a script. Someone has transcribed the script online.
Right.
If you can find a game that someone has actually transcribed the whole script to, then you can do things like look up words ahead of time. And, you know, not to jump into like what Nihongo is and the app that I make, what that's all about, but being able to actually pull out vocabulary words and follow along and be able to look at a script and look up words really easily while you're playing. Because if you're looking at a TV screen, there's, you know, if you encounter a word that you don't know, it can be really hard to look things up. So that's another thing I definitely look for ahead of time before picking a game.
Yeah, I think it's a huge time saver trying to look up every... Well, not you shouldn't probably look up every word you don't know. That's a recipe for, for boredom and probably quitting too. But yeah, to your point, when you encounter a kanji, either like in a printed text or on a TV screen, and if you don't know how it's pronounced, then the only way you could look it up in a dictionary, you know, is to usually write it. And unfortunately with Japanese, they don't have at least on iOS, they don't have a built-in Japanese specific handwriting keyboard. There's a Chinese one for traditional characters, which you can use. It's mostly the same. I mean, I would say like 85-90% of the time it works, but every so often it's like, oh darn it, there isn't, you know, you'll write in the character and it's not going to be there because it's a little different. So, and I know we've talked previously about your app Nihongo, which is where we first got in touch, because I'd started using it just on my own and thought it was great, and I was like, I gotta reach out to the guy who made this, because this is like exactly what I would want, or what I would have built if I were to build my own dictionary. And I've tried dozens. You're welcome. Yeah, I've tried dozens and dozens. You know, there's lots that have really cool elements to them or cool features, but inevitably there's something about them that just pisses me off so much that I end up, you know, deleting them. And I think one of the things, you know, we can segue into this now, but one of the things I really appreciate that you just touched on about your app Nihongo is that it's based on and designed around learning from authentic content. I think that is like so important and so underappreciated. And part of how that works, again, what you were just alluding to here, is that you can paste in content into the clipboard that you have and then read that text and then look up any words from that text and save them into flashcards right there in the app in one slick kind of user-friendly way. So very, very cool. And I, you know, whether somebody uses this app or other way, you know, there's things like Link, for example, which is a, you know, they have a way to import content that way as well. So there are many roads to do this. I've decided just to only do this all in Nihongo. So everything's in one place. So I don't have like stuff in this app and then other stuff in another app. So finding the transcripts for video games, I think that's really smart. What are some other good sources that you have? So let's go past video games now. Let's get into reading content, for example, in terms of what you're doing now, but also in terms of if somebody is just getting into Japanese maybe, and they're just getting to the point where they are wanting to practice reading authentic content. Maybe they're like a lower intermediate level, for example. What are some good free, interesting, comprehensible sources of reading content that you found useful?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, maybe a little bit higher level than what you're describing, but I've been really happy with all of the Harry Potter books are available in Japanese. And that's a great resource just because, again, like if you've read them in English, I think you have that background to understand them. They're also DRM free, which is really nice, pretty rare for ebooks. And the benefit of that is that you can actually extract the text from them to put into Link or Nihongo or something like that. So I found that a really powerful sort of workflow to study and to read. Other than that, I've basically like looked for recommendations from friends for like, there's a whole category of like light novels in Japanese. And so I've definitely looked for that. Things that are based, another good approach is finding like light novels. A lot of time, like different anime and manga are based on light novels or things like that. For example, there was that movie, Your Name, Kimi no Na wa. So that's another one that there's like was originally based on a novel, which, you know, if you've seen the anime, you like have sort of a good context, good background to be able to read that. And again, not worry about sort of getting lost and really be able to keep up and have that context and enjoy it.
Yeah, those are great. And I think the power of story is, you know, cannot be understated when you have again, back to comprehensible input, that's a big part of it, I think, is when you have a narrative arc or a story, it's so much easier to kind of deduce what's happening and to be interested and curious long enough to stick with it. You know, as opposed to just reading something that's like nonfiction, which I do a lot of. I mean, I love nonfiction.
Yeah.
I'm a junkie. But from a language learning perspective, especially, I try to do a little more fiction than I would in English. Just because I think you have that extra layer of like narrative and structure and flow. And, you know, you want to know what happens. So you kind of have that extra incentive to keep going and figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's super powerful. And helps your brain, I think, just on a subconscious level, grasp onto things better, too. Like, I find the way that my brain works, at least, if I have some sort of scenario, some sort of scene in my head that I can attach a word to, it just helps the recall so much in the future. If I can think of, oh, that I remember that word, you know, happened when Dumbledore was scolding Harry for X, Y, or Z. You're like, yeah, I don't know, different things like that. Like, those sort of scenes are super powerful for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you have little, you know, cognitive barbs to attach stuff to.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Do you find it useful then for that purpose? Do you find it useful to also watch the movies? For example, like if you can, I mean, probably ideally from a language learning perspective, if you can find Harry Potter dubbed into Japanese, that would be ideal. I don't know if those are available for that particular movie. Dubbing, I know, is going to become less popular. I think they usually do just subs for American movies brought into Japan these days. Unfortunately, the other is also true. They tend to dub Japanese stuff into English, especially anime, which is super annoying, I think. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely can be useful. I find it sometimes, for like having those moments that I can kind of capture in my brain and like associate a particular word with, or, you know, I'll really notice a certain way that, you know, a certain way that a certain character talks or something. Like I think there's so many, for example, in Japanese, there are a bunch of different ways to say I or me.
Right.
There's like boku, ore, watashi.
Yeah.
And there's one, I think Snape uses wagahai. And it's like this sort of obscure one.
Yeah.
Like, okay, now like I kind of get, okay, I kind of know what like Snape's vibe is. Now I can kind of like associate that. I've also been doing, so it's also helpful. I have a 3-year-old son, and so I got him now. We have like the Japanese version of Disney Plus, which is called Disney Deluxe in Japan. And have a ton of dubs, Japanese dubs of all those things, and that's been a good.
So does that require a VPN, I'm assuming, to do that?
Yeah. Requires a VPN,
Right, which, by the way, if those listening are not familiar with this, so VPN's a virtual private network. It's basically just a tool you use to trick some of these service providers into thinking that you are geolocated in Japan, because there's a lot of content restrictions where content is usually only allowed to be in certain regions, which is a real bummer for those of us that are trying to learn, for example, Japanese, not in Japan, because there's like this treasure trove of content that's locked behind this IP wall. So it's not 100%, but usually, depending on the VPN you have, if you set it up right, and you know, you can have, you might have to experiment with different protocols. I think there's 3 different main types, and I'm not sure which one you got to work for Disney. I know like for Amazon Prime Video, for example, they're starting to really crack down, and there's a lot of stuff I used to be able to watch on Amazon Japan that now I can't. That's all. I'll put that in the show notes, about more about that. So, good little trick, which I know there's probably questionable legality around that. So proceed with caution and knowing the implications. So anyway,
I feel like the motive here is honorable though. So
yeah, you're paying for it. That's, I think that's the key. You're not stealing this. You're not downloading illegal content. You're paying for a service that you'd be able to access if you happen to live in Japan. So anyway, I think that that's enough of that disclaimer. So let's go back a little bit to your journey of learning Japanese and visiting Japan. Do you have any favorite either linguistic gaffes or cultural gaffes or mistakes that you have? I always find this kind of a fun thing to remember, like, because we all make mistakes. You know, we all put our foot in our mouth. We all say the wrong word. You know, one of my favorite examples is when Tim Ferriss was at his homestay in high school in Japan. He was trying to ask his host mother to wake him up at 8 o'clock, but he accidentally asked her to rape him at 8 o'clock, right? Because okosu and okasu, right? One vowel difference. So, anything like that come to mind?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest things for me has been, so being married to another man and going to Japan, where that's like just not super well understood or well known, at least in the areas where I was, that led to a whole bunch of confusion all the time. So yeah, and I'll preface this by saying I never felt any sort of negativity about it. I always felt really positive, but I never felt any hatred aimed at me or anything. But
maybe ignorance or just, unfamiliarity, not a hate filled prejudice,
exactly,
or
just confusion. Confusion. So trying to figure out the right words to use was tricky because. So when you're learning Japanese, you might learn like shujin and okusan as being like husband and wife.
Right.
But the trick with those words is, as I've learned, there's so much, gender role imbued in them. And so we had like one interaction where someone's, you know, asking like, okay, well, who's the wife? Who's the okusan? And they're like, well, no, there is no wife. Like we're two men. It's like, well, who does the dishes? And I'm like, what?
We both did, like, right?
Yeah, like,
yeah.
So then we switched to using otto is another word for husband that we can use, and that kind of has its own issues. One of the things that comes up all the time is that otto, which means husband, sounds really similar to ototo, which means little brother.
Right.
So, and me and my husband kind of look kind of similar, so enough so that someone might think we're actually brothers. So all the time it's like, yeah, this is my otto, and he's okay, you're ototo, I get it. I'm like, well,
or maybe they assume you meant that, and so they fill in that phonetically in their head, they fill in those syllables.
So there was a lot of like, okay, I know you're just like, you're not quite getting the word right, you know, but yeah, so that happened a lot. Maybe my favorite story, though, was one of Justin's, one of my husband, his name is Justin, one of his students. So he was teaching English at a high school. And so we were kind of like trying to explain this to one of his students and explaining the word dousei kekkon, which means like same sex marriage.
Right.
And she just didn't quite get what that meant. And so she like looks at us for a while, looks at her friends, and then looks at us and goes, so you have two wives? Like, no.
Yeah.
That's so lots of confusion.
It's another, I think, interesting phenomenon is if you use terminology that is accurate, like you said, exactly the right word, you pronounced it properly, it's just not maybe a word that everybody is familiar with. And so it just doesn't quite register in their head, even though you said it correctly. And this happens, I mean, outside of this context, in any kind of context. Like, for example, I'm really passionate about linguistics. And so I've learned a lot of very technical terminology about linguistics in Japanese. And so I'll say a word to somebody, and if they're not also into linguistics, it's probably not a word they've heard before, or at least they don't fully understand what it is. And so there could be a lot of confusion with that too. So yeah, this happens a lot. But yeah, interesting that because of the cultural state, and I imagine, I mean, when I was there in 2003, 2005, it seemed like, and I know this probably sounds offensive to some listeners, but it seemed like in many ways, in terms of like equality and like social progress, they were about 30 years behind in many ways where like the US and like Western Europe are now. Not to say we're better. I just think like there are certain trends and there's cultural evolution that happens. And I'm curious, since you just visited recently, did you see any progress in that regard, or is it kind of same-o from what you experienced?
It's hard to say, because I think when I go back there now, I'm in my own, like, I have friends that I know, and I'm like,
and you're traveling, you're not living or working in it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like I think when Justin was teaching at a high school, you know, that was like, he got the, you know, exposure to that all the time. So it's hard to say a little bit, but I think they're also, I think, like you say, I think there's a certain capacity for a society to sort of process cultural change and you know, this sort of progress. And when I'm there right now, like the thing that really seems to be top of mind was there's a question about whether women can keep their own last name when they get married, you know. And so I almost feel like there's only enough capacity maybe for them to process that, and like I don't know.
You can't change everything all at once.
And I'm hopeful, though. I heard that there's definitely been progress in a bunch of different areas in Japan now have partnership laws that help to support, same-sex couples. And there seems to be a little bit of loosening of like visa restrictions and things like that. So I think it's slow but moving. It's just something that like isn't talked about super publicly, it feels like there. That's been at least my experience. It felt like if you were gay, it's still, very much something you'd keep quiet. And so I think just the lack of visibility around it just makes everything moves really slowly. So
yeah,
that's my take on it.
Yeah, that seemed to be the case when I was there speaking to some of my like expat friends who were there at the time, that was kind of what they said is like, in many ways, he said it actually was advantageous compared to what he had experienced in the States, like where it's like, it seemed like there are the two extremes. On the one hand, there's many people that are like completely like, of course, do whatever, live your life. And then there's the other extreme, which we know is not so open or accepting.
Yeah.
Whereas there, it was just, there was a dichotomy, but it was just between those in the community and then those who are out and just didn't really know anything about it. So it's kind of anyway, which is interesting. So other than otto, did you ever figure out other vocabulary that, if any listeners are, maybe moving to Japan and are going to have a similar situation? Like, is there a word emerging such as like partner or something like that? That is, I wonder.
I think definitely katana is something I've heard, but for me, I think otto has definitely been what I've settled on as sort of a good word that I think represents the relationship well. And
right.
Everybody seems to understand.
Once they get over the fact, you're not talking about a little brother. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting. So let's shift gears a little bit now from sort of the cultural side of stuff into actual language learning, the nitty gritty where the rubber meets the road, as it were. Every language has certain unique challenges. And then also there's sort of like universal challenges that just language learning involves, no matter the language. So I do see, for whatever reason, I see with Japanese, there are a lot of beliefs. There are a lot of things I would call myths or misconceptions. But I'm curious what, from your point of view, now having been at this for so long and having, met other learners and now developing an app that's helping other people learn Japanese as well, what are some common mistakes or misconceptions about learning Japanese? Or languages in general that you've encountered?
I think the first one that comes to mind for me is, especially for people that are new to the language, I think there's a lot of fear around the writing system that I think gets a little bit blown out of proportion. I think people talk about, oh God, there's three different alphabets you have to learn in Japanese. Right. And one of them has thousands of characters. And it's right. Like, okay, that sounds scary. But I actually sort of have a different perspective on that where, when you look at hiragana and katakana, first off, they're really two sides of the same coin, right? They're like every character in hiragana has a corresponding character in katakana. They represent the same set of sounds. Many of them look similar across them. Many of them don't, but a good chunk of them look the same or have similarities. And to me, we have the exact same thing in English, in uppercase and lowercase characters. I think
that's a good analogy. I haven't heard that before. I like that.
Yeah. So they are one-to-one. They represent the same sounds. A lot of them look similar, but a lot of them don't. And so to me, when people say, talk of those as two different alphabets, I sort of think, well, would you call uppercase and lowercase letters two different alphabets?
Right.
I don't think so.
Or cursive. So, it's another similar thing to think of. Yeah.
It's like, okay, here are characters that are just used in different contexts. We use one versus the other.
Right.
The context where you use them is very different from English lowercase and uppercase letters versus hiragana and katakana.
Do you want to go into that real quick, just for the sake of listeners? Like how are hiragana and katakana used if somebody's like completely new to Japanese and they're not familiar, or if they just started learning them?
The very basic thing that the first thing you'll learn is that katakana is used for loan words. So words that come from a different language. So if I'm going to say, hotodogu, like hot dog, I'll write that in katakana. If I'm going to say, a Japanese word, obento, like some Japanese food, that's a Japanese word, that would be in hiragana.
Or kanji. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
Or kanji.
Or a combination of the two.
There's also some other uses for katakana. For example, when you're talking about like animals and plants in a more like academic context, you'll usually see those written in katakana, even if they're native Japanese words. It's sometimes used for just emphasis, almost like italics or something like that. It's sometimes used just, you know, I play a lot of video games. So like, it's sometimes used just to like create an interesting voice for somebody, like robots. I find in video games, robots always speak in katakana.
That's well, because it looks kind of futuristic so, too. I think it has a modern connotation. Yeah. Sharp edges. Exactly. Yeah. Angular. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's like the major difference. So it's definitely different than uppercase, you know, it's not, you know, use one of the first letter of a word of a sentence or anything like in English, but they are direct. There is a direct mapping between the two. And then you get to kanji, and kanji, I think, again, a lot of people can get intimidated when they like, okay, they've tackled these two alphabets or these, you know, first two writing systems, and then they get to kanji and they think, oh God, I have, you know, 2000 plus you know, characters. But the way that I like to think of this is, in a way, I think learning kanji kind of replaces learning spelling in learning like a European language or something. You learn a new word, and in Japanese, one, since it's phonetic, you don't actually have to learn like the spelling in hiragana or anything. You don't have to learn the phonetic alphabet spelling of it. But in order to learn how to write it, you do need to learn the kanji. So I think it kind of fills that role. And at least that's been, this isn't universal. Like, I think a lot of people take different approaches to learning kanji. But the way that I've generally approached it has been like learning them along with vocabulary. And so you're not going to like get to the end of katakana and then just start, you know, from the beginning, just go through and learn all the kanji. You'll learn kanji over the whole time that you're learning Japanese as you expand your vocabulary. And it's kind of just another aspect of learning Japanese is slowly learning those kanji as well.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot actually that maybe when you're just starting off, you don't realize, but once you get used to a fair number of kanji and you start to see these patterns, there's a lot about them that are very advantageous to a learner. I like to point out that, you know, most of them, people have this idea that kanji are like pictographs, but actually the vast majority are idiophonetic compounds. So you have like one chunk, which tells you or points to how it's pronounced. It's not like 100% accurate, of course, but there are patterns. And then one chunk kind of points at the meaning of it. So like, okay, this one has a woman radical. So it's probably something related to women or something, or this one has the word radical. So it's probably something related to communication or speaking. And then, oh, it has this other chunk, which is pronounced like this. So then, you know, when you see a new kanji, for example, if you know both those patterns, you can often guess what it means, or at least what it's related to and how it's probably pronounced. And then I think the really powerful thing happens when, once you do know the vast majority, at least of the standard use kanji, when you encounter a new word or a new compound, if you know the meaning of each constituent kanji, you can often guess the meaning of the compound. Not always, not 100%, but it's a pretty darn good thing that I always make the analogy that in English, it'd be like if you knew Latin and Greek. Knowing kanji is kind of like having those two languages, and that way you can parse apart etymology of English words you've never seen before. But very few of us know that. I don't know Greek. I don't know much Latin, so I have to look up the word in the dictionary, but anyway, I always found that really fascinating with Japanese, that you kind of have this, it's a lot more, to be nerdy about it, it's semantically transparent much more than English is in many ways. So anyway, yeah, I think kanji is a fascinating topic, and, I appreciate you kind of putting people at ease a little bit that it, yes, it's going to take time. Yes, there is a lot to learn there, but it's doable. I mean, every Japanese child does it by the time they graduate from high school. And I think as adult learners, actually, we can do it a lot faster because we can go about it in a more, I think, adult friendly, intelligent way instead of just the rote memorization that they do in Japan. I personally am a big fan of remembering the kanji. I do think that was really helpful. Yeah. I know that's a controversial thing. Some people love it. Some people hate it. I found it very helpful. But there are definitely many, many ways to go. There's Wani Kani. There's, you know, in the Nihongo app as well, you do have kanji modules to help people go through those. And I know more is coming soon for more advanced levels. As you said, reading in context, you know, going back to video games and and Harry Potter books, you're going to be seeing the most common kanji over and over and over again in context. So yeah, it's doable. Do not be afraid.
Definitely doable.
Do not be afraid. Take it one bite at a time. There's this great interview with Will Smith that I always remember, that he was talking about when he was a kid, that his dad had asked him and his brother to build a brick wall. It was like during summer break or something. And they were looking at this giant pile of bricks sitting there, and they just were like overwhelmed by the enormity of this task. And his dad very wisely said, just pick up one brick and then lay that brick down. And that's all you're going to do. Like, instead, don't think about that pile of bricks. Think about each individual brick. And I think that's a really good way to think about kanji too, is one brick at a time.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even have to know all 2,000 of the Joyo kanji to like be highly functional and 100%. Have, you know, be reading and doing a whole lot. Yeah. You don't have to feel like that's a barrier you have to get through. It's just part of the process.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And a couple other things to share if somebody is new to Japanese is things like in manga, many, depending on the level or the target audience, a lot of them have little reading guides next to the kanji. They're little hiragana called furigana, and those can help you, because even if you don't know that kanji, or even if you don't know how it's pronounced, those little reading guides tell you how it's pronounced, and then you can look it up in Nihongo or whatever app. That's a good little hack. And I also want to say that I think for most people today, recognition is a lot more useful than production. So not many people are writing out kanji every day by hand these days. They're mostly typing it using English letters, in fact. I mean, either on your keyboard, on your phone, or on your computer. So I think as long as you can recognize them, you're pretty well ahead of the curve. Also want to say that there's like an 80-20 rule here where, and I forget the exact percentage, but I think the most common 100 kanji account for like 50% of all written material on Japanese Wikipedia. I might have the exact number wrong, but the point is like a very small percentage.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
Kanji account for like the vast majority. It's like Green Eggs and Ham. You know, he wrote the whole book with 50 words. And it's kind of the same idea. So anyway, do not fear the kanji. It's doable. Any other myths or misconceptions that you maybe yourself had thought previously and then changed your mind about, or those that you see a lot or hear a lot about in the Japanese learning community?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I've definitely heard from both Japanese people and other people in the Japanese learning community is to not try to use video games, manga, anime to learn Japanese. Yeah. I think there's this idea that, oh, you're going to learn all these weird ways of speaking that people don't actually use.
Right.
And which, sure, that exists in there. And if that was your only exposure to Japanese, that would be bad. But I think that's one that like I totally reject, that I think I get so much value out of. We've talked about it before, but just having content that I'm actually enjoying and engaged in, and I can get a lot out of, even if you can lose yourself into there is a lot of like weird speech patterns and stuff, but I think you can kind of ignore that
you know that it's weird, or you know, I think once you've been at it a while, you realize like, okay, this is informal, this is more formal, this is
right.
This is how to sound like a yakuza, this is how to sound like a 14-year-old girl. Like I think you start to realize.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah. I think that's really interesting that there is this undercurrent of poo-pooing authentic content like this, and that there's some people have kind of a hierarchy of input and value, that like textbooks and NHK news or something is like up at the top, and then this more pulp, you know, pop content is somehow lesser than. And I agree with you. I reject that. I think that's silly. Do whatever works for you. I mean, if you like textbooks, go for it. But I have not met many Japanese learners who enjoy learning through textbooks or memorizing like conjugation tables. Like not usually an inherently fun way to learn. A little bit of it can help, I think, every so often going back and looking at it and going, oh, okay, yeah, that's right. That's how that works.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a place for it for sure. But it's never going to be the most engaging thing for sure.
I wonder about this. I have a theory that, especially with a language like Japanese that is perceived as being so difficult, I refuse to call any language difficult. I always say it's different. Japanese is very mm-hmm. different from English, with the exception, of course, of the 10,000 plus English loanwords that are in Japanese. But I feel like there's this idea that some Japanese learners have that because they themselves force themselves through this tedious, rote, textbook-based, banging your head against the table method, and then they finally got to mm-hmm. a point where they've reached fluency through a really hard way, there's sort of an arrogance or an ego about that. And mm-hmm. then when they hear other people saying, like, no, learning should be fun. No, you can just, you know, you can watch anime and read manga. Like, you don't need to read a textbook. There's probably a frustration that, like, deep down they know that that's probably right, and they regret not having done that themselves. Or they want to maintain that their way they did it is the noble, righteous way to do it. That's, you know, the sadistic way is the righteous way.
And then when my husband was teaching English in Japan, I got to look at some of the textbooks that they're using in a Japanese high school to teach English. It just, they seem soul crushing. Yeah. They're like a book. There's a book that's 10,000 English words basically in random order.
Yeah.
Like, okay, light pole, airplane,
right.
You know, kick, like,
right.
I don't know, just like a total, just no rhyme or reason to it. And it's like,
no context.
Almost like someone just tried to come up, what is the most painful, like, context free way we could possibly teach people language? And you're just like,
yeah, it's so heartbreaking because they do it and they work so hard. I mean, I taught English my first year in Japan also. And it's heartbreaking because they spend hours every day on just English. That's not even including their other subjects. Kind of like what you were saying with Japanese for you in school. It's like, you know, that because that method is so ineffective, they have to spend, you know, instead of trying to figure out a more effective or efficient way, they just do more of the ineffective way.
Right.
And then these people, you know, they emerge from 10 years plus of English study and they can't communicate. And then, of course, being part of the cultural thing, they don't blame the method. They blame themselves. They think, oh, I just didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't juku hard enough, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, no, like you're fine. Your method sucks.
The method is really, 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 really bad.
Yeah. So. And that's the same way Japanese is usually taught because they just took that same thing and then they just apply it to teaching Japanese to foreigners. So, which is part of why I started blogging. And, you know, it's why I wrote Master Japanese in the first place is because I saw that. I saw that that is the default and it's so ineffective and so painful for the vast majority of people. Like, there's a better way. And so that's what I've been trying to espouse. But definitely now, 10 years on, I mean, there's a lot more voices now talking about exactly this. There's a lot more people that are promoting a more natural, fun, context-based, story-based, input-based way of going about this. So, and that's actually another thing I wanted to touch on here. So we talked a lot about input already. So listening and reading, which is obviously an essential half of the coin. But there's this other half of the coin, speaking and writing, which is called output, that I think for a lot of learners is really intimidating because, you know, you can't pause a live conversation. You can't stop and look up words you don't know. And that's all happening in real time. So a lot of people, I think, out of fear of making mistakes, out of fear of not understanding or being misunderstood, they will put off practicing speaking, especially. How did you go about learning to speak Japanese? And what advice do you have for those that are at that stage where they're still stuck like in an input bubble?
Yeah, I mean, I think having someone that you're going through that kind of journey with is really helpful for one thing. Yeah, just having people to speak with. When I think about it, though, I think the big thing for me was honestly moving to Japan. It was being able to actually have that, like, real, I need to get over my fear of using this to go real buy starve. Groceries.
Yeah, or, you exactly.
Know. Yeah, exactly. Like, that certainly was huge. Because, yeah, I definitely had that. I definitely had that that fear of actually using it and that fear that you're going to make a mistake or, you know, and be embarrassed and all of that sort of stuff. And there is just a certain point where, like, you have to just push past it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think having people around you that you can trust, that you feel comfortable with has been really helpful for me. And now, I mean, I think having Japanese friends to speak to is really, really helpful. Although obviously that's, you know, not available for a lot of people.
But there's always, you know, italki and other tutoring sites. That's probably the most common sort of objection that I hear from people is like, okay, you say practice speaking, but I don't live near any native speakers. I don't have any Japanese friends. I guess I'm out of luck. It's like, no, do you have an internet connection? Yes. Okay. You're good. You just need the courage to do it.
Yeah.
You don't even need the money. I mean, yes, you can pay for tutors and I do think that's well worth it. You can get awesome professional teachers for like $15 to $20 an hour. It's crazy. I mean, it's way underpriced, I think, for the value you get, but you can do exchanges. Like if you're not in a economic situation where you can afford to pay for tutors, you can always just do an exchange where you do half in English and then half in Japanese. There are many, many ways. I've also in recent years been doing more of, you know, we talked about earlier, changing your phone to your target language. And one of the advantages there is that you can actually talk to your phone too. Now, you can ask Siri or Google Assistant in Japanese for a question, or you can give directions, you know, or say, you know, take me home. And then, you know, it opens Maps and then Maps is talking to you in Japanese. So yeah, there's so many cool things you can do these days. Part of me always wonders like, if I could, you know, somehow snap my fingers and like, start learning Japanese now for the first time. I wonder how different it would be. Or like,
yeah, for sure. I mean, I just think about when I started, you know, was pre iPhone, pre, you know, things. So it was just like paper flashcards and things like that. And I mean, and I think that gets to part of why I built Nihongo originally was just this feeling of like, there's a certain amount of time you're dedicating to learning language that's actually going to like building those connections in your brain and improving your language skills. And then there's a certain amount that goes, that's just kind of time you're dedicating to language learning that's not actually helping anything that, you know, if you can cut out as much of that as possible. Yeah. So I think about this with like, I remember looking up kanji and paper kanji dictionaries. And I just think about all the wasted time
of trying
to look things up. And I'm like, okay, let's cut all that out.
Yeah.
With flashcards, I think there's a certain amount of value to writing out flashcards. I'll certainly give it that. But I think the amount of time spent, I don't think is quite.
Yeah. Like, the cost benefit analysis.
Exactly.
Yeah. It doesn't work out very well.
So I think about, just like the ability to make flashcards really easily, which was really the initial sort of killer feature I was trying to get at for Nihongo, was to be able to just like automatically generate flashcards for you.
Right. Which you've done. And I think that's like, that's what I use it for every single day. I mean, like one of my workflows now is like, I will wake up in the morning. I will go usually find like a Japanese Wikipedia article on some topic that I wanted to learn about anyway in English. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, often I'll read the English article to kind of get a context. Then I'll go, if there is a Japanese version of that page, I'll click that and then I'll copy the text, pop it into Nihongo, and then I'll work through that. Even though I've been at Japanese for off and on for like 2 decades, I learn new words every day and it's great.
Yeah.
But it's words like related to some topic I'm interested in, not just some back to that book of 10,000 random words. You couldn't pay me enough to try to learn words that way. But doing it this way, I'm just reading. I'm learning about some topic, and then the Japanese almost becomes secondary in a way. It's just the means to the end.
Yeah. And then you build all those connections to those words that's going to help you recall them in the future.
Yeah.
Another thing I end up finding a lot is just being able to like have those connections and have them sort of stored for the future too. So I love that if I like look up a word, I can, one of the things you can do with Nihongo is go back and see like contained in clippings, and it'll show you exactly where you saw that word before.
Yes. So I love that.
Saw this word, you know, when I was reading the Wikipedia page about, you know, the Meiji restoration or something, you know, like I know.
That was, I stumbled upon that. I didn't even realize that was the case. And I was like, just looking at something in a dictionary, and then, it had that containing clipping. It's like, oh, that's cool. There's stuff like that all the time. I keep discovering more new things and tricks. And I know you keep updating it too and adding more features. I think you said on Twitter that you're working on OCR. Is that something in the works?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now.
Cool. Yep. So for those that are listening, if you're not familiar, so it's optical character recognition. So you'd be able to like point your phone at printed text, whether in a physical book or probably even on a TV screen, if you are watching a movie or a video game or something, and then it'll automatically recognize the character. So another time saver. So we don't have to make these poor learners go into a paper kanji dictionary and waste years of their life.
No, it's exciting. Like I've just been using it myself so far, and I am finding just all these workflows that I couldn't do before that I can do now, like looking up words. We were talking about how if you're seeing something on a screen and you have to go and actually try and use the, you know, Japanese like kanji keyboard or the traditional Chinese keyboard and try and write it, but then you get the stroke order wrong and you have to redo it.
Right.
So just pull all that out and just point your camera at it and look it up.
Smart.
So, yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Any idea when we can expect something like that, or is that still tightly under wraps?
My hope is by the end of April, probably.
Cool.
So could be a couple months off, but
yeah. Well, I imagine, and I know it's, you don't have a massive team of minions, you know, probably toiling away at this.
This is just me. So
yeah, just, hey, I feel you. So is this, you know, like, it's always funny when I get like a email from a reader or something, or like, you know, make sure to thank the team for the good.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I will.
I get a lot of like, you're in the younger development team. And I'm like, that's me.
Yeah. Boku, ore.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, well done. Again, thank you for building something that's so helpful, especially for independent, context-based, you know, authentic content-based learning, which is so much about, you know, my narrative, my philosophy about language learning. And yeah, if people haven't tried it yet, I highly recommend it. It is on iOS only. I don't know if there's plans to do a Android version in the future or not. I know that's like, again, it's just you, so that'd be like a whole other full-time job you probably don't want.
Yeah, I'd love to do it someday, but probably not anytime soon.
Yeah. So kind of to wrap up here, just a few kind of rapid-fire questions. So back to resources a little bit. Is there like a particular book or tool or resource that you recommend most to language learners, specifically Japanese? And this could be, you know, other than Nihongo, obviously.
Yeah. You know, I think we touched on a little bit, but I think just finding content, finding like, game scripts is one thing that I just don't see talked about a lot that I've had immense success with.
Are there any sites you recommend for that?
No, I have a blog post that I wrote up about this on like how to search for them. And I'm trying to actually start a page that sort of catalogs some of the ones that are out there and link to them.
Sure.
I honestly, I recommend your book to people a lot.
Thank you.
so I think that just has a lot of great tips for and techniques for how to approach studying. So I always feel like kind of one of these things where like you can put so much energy into it, but if you're not using that energy in kind of the right direction in the right way, it's not as useful. And I think your book is really great at just like pinpointing where to put all your energy into to making the most efficient use of your time to learn a language. So
great. That was the goal. So I'm glad that has come through. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, I don't know. I guess those are kind of the big things that I'd recommend. Living in Japan, it was an immensely transformative experience for me, both in my Japanese language learning and, you know, broader in my life. But so I definitely recommend, if you're interested and really serious about it, for sure, trying to apply to the JET program, apply to, you know, other ways to try to get to Japan too.
Yeah, JET is amazing. I mean, in so many ways, that was also how I got to Japan, definitely. So it can be tough to get into. There's more applicants than there are spots by many timefold. And they typically tend to only take people like fresh out of college. That's kind of their first choice. So if you're already many years into a career or post-college, it can be tough to get into, but that's only one way to get to Japan, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are many routes. Yeah. Okay. And then kind of my last question for you is, we've talked a lot about kind of the misconceptions and some of the like fears people have, especially with a language like Japanese. But if somebody really wants to get started in Japanese, maybe they are going to be moving to Japan, maybe they are in the JET program, or they got accepted and they know they're moving to Japan soon. Maybe they have a Japanese relative, or maybe they're of Japanese descent and they've always wanted to learn Japanese. You know, there are a lot of different whys, but how would you recommend somebody get started? You know, what are the absolute essential first steps that you think they should make so they can avoid wasting time and diffusing their energy in 1,000 directions.
I've touched on this a little bit before, but I think finding someone to go through that journey with you is super important, and having that sort of help. It's hard to say. I mean, I think there's a lot of different paths people can take. Definitely. I think my experience was taking classes, and I think that was totally worked for me, and totally I was able to sort of like get into the whole world that way. Uh-huh. And I'm not sure I think there was like a particular better path.
I think maybe there we can underscore that you did take classes, but you also were immersing yourself in video games and in manga and in anime. And I think, you know, one could argue that the two together probably is a pretty powerful combination. I'll say that.
Yeah.
I do think that, you know, the classroom component of it, I think, can be very helpful if you're motivated. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's often used as an excuse not to learn at all, because people say, I don't have time and I don't have money to take classes. Yeah. And so for those folks, I'm always like, okay, no problem. Again, like, do you have an internet connection? Cool. All right. We got this.
Yeah.
But definitely. Yeah. If you can do classes, awesome. If you can go to Japan, awesome. I mean, you and I have both had both of those experiences and they were transformative. Mm-hmm. I just think the key point I always coming back to again and again and again is like, neither one is a condition. They're an advantage, but they're not like a requirement. So if you want it, you can do it.
Yep, definitely. And I think you can finding something that you're passionate about and that you're interested in is huge. That's what's going to keep you coming back to it and not lose the motivation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I see this all the time that they think like they need to read newspapers, for example. And I'm like, do you read the newspaper in English? And they're like, no. I'm like, well then why are you reading the newspaper in Japanese? Like, you don't need to read the newspaper. You can if you want, but there's other things you could do. And again, there's this, I think, absurd hierarchy of reading, for example, like somehow newspapers and novels are up here and then blog posts and emails and text messages are down here. And it's like, why? It's all reading. It's all input.
Right. Yeah. And you can also, I mean, you could like keep on learning new target, like vocabulary in a certain direction forever, you know? And so if you're going to put in the effort, why put it towards something that you don't really care about?
Exactly.
So
yeah, if you're into underwater basket weaving, then by golly, go find some Japanese content about underwater basket weaving.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not personally, so that's not for me. For me, it's nerdy linguistic stuff and ninjas, you know, that's how I roll. Cool, Chris. Well, thank you so much for your time and for all the work and the love that's so evident in your app and the stuff you continue to put out. I'll throw all that in the show notes. And if folks do want to connect or learn more, where should they go?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Vaselli. That's CHRISVASSELLI. You can check out, if you want to learn more about Nihongo, our website is nihongo-app.com. That's probably it.
Sounds good. All right. Well,
thank you so much, John.
Thank you. Happy learning. Take care.
All right.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening. For show notes, again, go to languagemastery.com/show. And if you enjoyed what you heard, I'd highly appreciate a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. And you can also check out languagemastery.com, where you'll find a blog with over 150 free articles on how to learn languages through immersion anywhere in the world. There you'll also find my books, Master Japanese and Master Mandarin. And I also have a free 7-day email course on how to create a Japanese immersion environment anywhere in the world. All right, we will see you next week for the next edition of the Language Mastery Show.